Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Billy Collins is a former poet laureate of the United States and is the author of 12 collections of poetry, including the bestsellers Aimless Love, Sailing Alone Around the Room, and The Trouble with Poetry. His latest collection is Water, Water. It is a collection of 60 new poems where Collins explores the subtle beauties and ironies of daily life. Collins is a former distinguished professor at Lehman College of the City University of New York and also served as New York State poet. In 2016, he was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters. I spoke with Billy Collins in front of a live audience at UAlbany's Page Hall in downtown Albany, New York. We welcome Billy Collins to this week's book show.
Do you get excited when you have a new collection out?
Yeah, it's exciting. I think of the book as a commodity. I'm not above thinking that book sales are a business. And so, yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, we should all have such problems if it is a problem.
The process of putting a collection together, what is that like for you in the writing and the selection and figuring right. out what's going to go where?
Yeah. Well, that's a fun part. Well, basically, I'm never thinking about, as I'm writing a poem, I'm never thinking about it as being part of a book. I don't think of it as a brick that's going to go in the wall. It's part of something bigger. So all the poems are done individually, and I'd say it's like ball players say, we're just going to take one game at a time, as if there were an alternative to that. So it's just one poem at a time. And then after, it's usually every 2 years or so, I think maybe there's enough poems to make a book, and I'll kind of rake them together and see if, and often, you're not ready for a book, and keep writing. So if I have enough poems, if I have maybe 75 poems, I'll send them to my editor. And I've never really gotten much of a line edit, you know, for like sentence by sentence, or I find that a kind of invasion of privacy. But I asked my editor, who's a wonderful guy, David Ebershoff at Random House, to see if he can find a few weaker poems. Not too many, but maybe like a 6 or 7, maybe tops. But he'll find poems that don't seem to fit exactly or don't live up to the standard maybe set by the better poems. And that kind of narrows it down. I order the poems in some way. It's a bit mysterious. Hardly anybody, I think, reads a book of poems front to back. And I find someone else's book and I use it as a flip book, and I'm looking for kind of a weird title or a short poem or some point of insertion where I can read the book. So it's really assiduously ordering the poems putting them in a certain order is really an author's vanity. I mean, it's for fun for the author, but there's not much payoff for the reader.
But there has to be a pacing that you're looking for that you would like.
Well, less than you would think. I like to start with a strong poem. Somehow books have gotten in the habit of books of poetry being divided into usually 3 or 4 parts.
Right.
And maybe that's to just give the reader a break or I don't know what. But at least you can think about it coming in parts, and like a poem comes in stanzas, so that gives you something else to think about. So I would try to start with a couple of strong poems. Each section ends with a strong poem. Maybe the title poem begins one of the sections, that kind of thing. And then you have a point at the end of the book where, can I read this short poem?
Yes.
I want to read a pre-poem before that. This is the poem that I wrote a few years ago. It's called The Garland, and it's really a solution to the problem of mortality, if that doesn't get your attention. It's called The Garland. I would like to be laid to rest in a big tomb topped by the stone figure of an angel who appears to have landed there in order to sob forevermore, her face buried in her bent arm, one folded wing hanging by her side. Then, whenever I found the time to visit my own grave, after approaching with slow, respectful steps, I would place around her rough neck the garland of wildflowers that I knitted, then run back to the car laughing and immortal. And so that this is an answer to that poem. It ends water, water. It's called A Change of Heart. And the poet I refer to is Oshima Ryoto, an 18th century Japanese poet. A Change of Heart. I once expressed the wish for a tomb topped by a white marble angel, her head buried in her folded wing. But now I'd rather you just copy out that little poem by Ryota, fold it into quarters, then slip it into my shirt pocket before I am incinerated in a chamber. It's the one where he used to think that death came only to others, but now, in his ultimate hour, he realizes that this happiness is also his.
Before we came out, we were in the green room, and Billy said, well, I'm going to read some poems. And then I said, I've chosen some that I'm hoping you would read. So I gave him the poems, and I said, so those weren't in your menu, were they? And he said, no, I wouldn't have chosen those.
Never.
Now, what I want to know is, so what does that say?
I've never read them out loud, actually, so I don't know how they play. Maybe I'm wrong.
All right. Well, so the one that I wanted to start with, and it is Magical Realism.
Magical Realism. It's a rainy Saturday night in London, and many of the male dogs have gathered at their favorite pub, the Ball and Stick, where they lower their heads to drink from their bowls of ale. For this is not an off-the-wall cartoon where they would be leaning on the bar, holding a pint glass impossibly in one paw. No, this is just a bit of fiction, but not by a fantasist of South America, where many strange things are done. And that's why the dogs are not smoking cigars or playing darts or gossiping about their owners. Nor is there any laughter, no sports on the telly, no backslapping, which would require standing up all night on your hind legs. And that's also why it's so quiet for a Saturday night with your mates, unlike the clamor down the lane at the Axe and Hammer or around the corner at the King's Piston. Here is just the low sounds of lapping and a round of barking every time a new dog happens to walk into the door. Yes, on all fours, and without a stitch of clothes. So,
that played well.
All right, that was pretty good.
Yeah.
You're right. Well, I also said it's all gold, so.
Yeah, I did say that.
I was fooling with the dial of realism to surrealism. You know, I wanted to get around to six. They're still dogs. I wanted to retain their doggy nature without having them, you know, play poker and stuff like that.
Do you consciously do that of thinking about that it's going to be in about a six? Like, you don't want to go too far. You don't want to go.
I want to start out with a kind of Walter Cronkite voice here, I guess. It's a rainy night in London. Many of the male dogs have gathered in their favorite pub, the Ball and Stick. So it's kind of a reportorial voice, and I want to keep that sobriety throughout, even though the scene gets a little crazier. But I like a round of barking every time a new dog happens to walk in the door. And they get back to drinking beer. I don't know. I get paid for it.
Yeah. Good on you. Good.
Thank you there.
Page 50, Zero Grannies, which is just a great title.
Could be a punk band, Zero
yes,
Grannies.
Zero Grannies.
Playing at CBGB's. Well, this has the benefit of being true, the truth in the first few lines. Zero Grannies. By the time I was born, both of my grandmothers had died, so I never got a chance to observe one of them ironing in a hallway or sitting on a porch talking to herself about something or other. I have no poem to write about their aprons or their hands. Oh, those hands caked with flour that baked so many pies. It would take a windowsill a mile long for all of them to cool. I can't even picture one carrying her missal to church in the snow, nodding to the sacristan, while the other one remains confined to her room for some unknown reason. nor can I hear the clicking of their needles. So, reader, you can thank the mortality rate of 19th century North America for leaving this poet free to record things like five birds on a wire, a lost dog pausing under a streetlight, or three lemons doing nothing in a bowl. All four of my grandparents were dead when I was born, so I had no grannies or granddads. But that's okay. I didn't mind being an only child, and I didn't miss, you don't miss what you don't have, so I didn't miss the dandling or whatever else you do with your grandmother. I would rather write about a dog pausing under a streetlight and three lemons in a bowl or whatever than grandparents. Or I have very few people in my poems. There are very few in all these books. There's hardly anybody but me, the only child writer, because I want to be alone with the reader. And if I'm conducting a workshop, a poetry workshop, I have deal breakers. If I come across the word dad or grandpa, I just stop reading. I'm out, because if you want to write about your family and a bunch of other people, you should write fiction. The intensity of poetry is that you're alone with the reader. And when I was an only child, I started writing poetry now that I think about it, because it was really an intensification of being alone. I wanted to be more and more alone, like people who get tattoos and can't stop. I wanted to be super alone. And so in the poetry, I think it's a very private conversation between one person and another. If you have grannies in there and your brother and your uncle and all that stuff, I don't know. So being an only child and having very little family has turned out to be excellent preparation for writing poems, for my poems anyway.
Billy Collins is our guest. The new book is Water, Water. Do you think about, without having people, then that doesn't tell us a tremendous amount about you, right? I mean, it's we know about your thoughts, but there aren't a lot of things that we know.
No, I'm not an autobiographical poet. I mean, I bring you into the intimacy of what I'm thinking and imagining, but there's very little information. If you were basing a biography on me based on the poems, I mean, I had parents. That's undeniably true. And I have, they enter poems here and there. But no, you wouldn't know about, I'm not a conveyor of the past. Most of the poems include a present moment. So most of the poems take place, if they don't take place in the present moment of a certain time period, they take place in the present immediacy of the poem itself. That the poem, almost all the poems are composed in one sitting. And I do that because I want to find the ending. I mean, in class, they talk about the symbol of this and this metaphor, blah, blah, blah. I'm just thinking about how do I get out of this thing? I mean, I need to do something else.
So apropos of what we were just talking about, on page 113, it's a poem toward the end of the book, and It is in present, in the present.
I see what you're getting at.
See?
Yeah.
See?
Yeah, okay. You got me.
And
no need to read it. Really.
The name of it is Autobiography.
Autobiography. This morning I began writing mine, but 5 hours later, and many legal pads later, I had gotten only as far as my conveyance from the French hospital in New York City to my parents' apartment. Of course, I could have devoted less time to the bodily process of my birth, the details of my wicker bassinet, as well as the many metallic animals endlessly circling above me as I lay supine, helpless and staring. And so after a sandwich for lunch, with so much work ahead of me, including a catalog raisonné of my toys, an account of the tiles on the bathroom wall behind which resided my imaginary friend, I decided to abandon the whole project and maybe settle for a little essay on the subject of the wallpaper or the taste of prunes. Plus, I already could hear the voices of the vicious reviewers, happy to dwell on my shortcomings, my love of personification, the melancholy tricycle, for example, the limits of the first-person selfish point of view, not to mention the overall lack of a clear theme. And they would be right about the pages and pages of senseless dialogue, not to mention the tedium of chronological order, even though that seems to be the way my life has chosen to unfold itself, at least so far. So.
But that is an interesting point, and going back to what you were saying earlier, it isn't chronological in the sense of it's what you were thinking of at that moment and more, and I mean this as in a good way, of a scattered.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Well, one of the French filmmakers, Truffaut, I think, said that every film has a beginning, a middle, and an end, but not necessarily in that order. So, but also, poetry really frees you from chronology, unlike the novel, which you can play with time in the novel like Faulkner, but basically things roll chronologically. And there's no genre of written expression that offers more imaginative freedom, I think, than poetry. Freedom from chronology, for example. And you can be anywhere you want at any time and jump all over the place imaginatively. Sex is not required, as it is in the novel, and other bourgeois concerns, so to speak.
When you think of something, and from the time you have the thought, from the time of knowing that to the time of writing about it, how much time passes?
No, almost no time. It's game on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any time I think of a way to begin a poem or a possibility, it's totally game on. I just get after it right away and don't talk to me. And so I go deep and I'm lose the sense of time and I'm just focused there. And that's very much a part of the self-entertaining aspect of writing poems, that you're in this thing and it's going to be new. No one else has done it. And you don't know what the ending is either. And so the ending's going to be some kind of surprise. And it's very exciting, mentally. I don't come to the page with a lot. I come with a little something. Someone said it's good to maintain the benefits of your ignorance for as long as you can when you're writing a poem.
So expand on that for a little bit. When you come to a poem with a little something, like what?
Well, I remember listening to Art Blakey's version of Three Blind Mice. You know, he's a jazz drummer, and I was listening to it. Of course, there are no words in the jazz tune, but I started wondering how he could, as a jazz man, think there would be melodic possibilities in such a stupid song, which is the same tune as Hot Cross Buns, I think. Three Blind Mice, Hot Cross Buns. You know, it's a kid's song. And then I remember I was cooking. I was chopping parsley and garlic and stuff like that. And I started just thinking about the mice and how they came to be blind. Forget dinner, you know. We get pizza, and I thought, you know, they could be, if it was congenital, they could be brothers and sisters. That's the way it starts. And I picture the poor mother brooding over her sightless young triplets. Or was it an explosion or something, a firework? If they each came to his or her blindness separately, how did they ever manage to find one another? And that was, how could it would be difficult for a blind mouse to locate even one with vision, let alone two other blind ones, right? And like that. You know.
So, oh, that's delightful. So you are interested in humor, right? You are interested in that moment. Am I just like when you were just saying that, like congenital is funny.
Yeah, right. Well, we were talking about mice, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, words. Some words can be funny, like, you know, collie is not funny, schnauzer is funny. I don't know. When I was trying to write poems when I was in high school, in that period, I didn't think poems could be funny, and they couldn't be without being consigned to this little outlet called light verse. Poetry was supposed to be serious. And I was funny in school. My father was very funny, and I inherited that from him. But then later I started reading poets who were funny but dead serious about their purpose, like Philip Larkin and people of the New York school, like Kenneth Koch and Frank O'Hara and others. And that was a big revelation for me that I could actually be funny as a, but not for its own sake, funny as a device, often a disarming device to get people into the poem. Because the poem can begin, obviously, you can modulate from humor to sadness or reality and go back to humor again. So it became a device. There's something authentic about humor, though. You know, you can, it's easy to pretend to be serious, right? If you've ever had a job, for example, or... or been in a classroom, or even now. I mean, Joe and I are you know, we're being serious about this, right? But and you can, all you have to do is go, interesting. And but you can't pretend to be funny. You know, either you're funny or you're not. I mean, you try to be funny around your friends and they don't laugh. It's like you're just bombed. But so there's something authentic about humor, and there's something also intriguing about causing an involuntary reaction in people, right? I mean, if you can make someone laugh, it's like making them sneeze. I mean, they can't help it. It's you have a little power over them, but I don't know.
So as you were reading to this audience earlier, and you were getting laughs, that feels good.
It feels good, but I also have to bring everyone under control at that point. No, I don't want it
can't
to...
Can't go too far.
Well, I don't want it to be a laugh-a-thon. And I have a list of poems. I look at the playlist and I jump all over the place and pick poems that are more serious. And if we're having too good a time, I'll put a more serious poem in. So that I'd like you all to leave here with a sense of pleasurable disorientation so that you don't know exactly, was that funny or what? Or but there was that thing about death, wasn't there? I don't know. What I try to do basically is avoid, there are two extremes in terms of tone. And one is hard and one is soft. One is sarcasm and the other is sentimentality. And there's a middle road, which is called irony. There's that the tragic face, that the down look of the, and then the rictus smile of comedy. And then I guess the irony is sort of sneering slightly, but irony is a way of avoiding those two extremes. And I try to maintain a balance in the poem so that it's funny, but wait a minute, something is happening that's not that funny.
We talked about this in the sense of a collection, but as you're working on something and you go into it and you say, if you use humor to bring us into the poem, and I realize it's a different form, but if you're writing a joke, you know, that's, you consider the punchline, but that for you then is an entry point and can go on from there.
It can start as something humorous, yeah. We have to realize that poetry is basically lines. You know, they come in, you're writing one line at a time. And that's, in addition to writing sentences, you're trying to write good lines. And there are many definitions of poetry, like, the best words in the best order, or meaning that moves, the dancing of an attitude, very clever definitions of poetry. But there's only one airtight definition of poetry I've ever heard from Henry Taylor, and he says poetry is an arrangement of lines whose length is determined by some principle other than the width of the page. Okay? The line does not go out to the end of the page. And that turning back, making the line then turning back into the poem, there used to be a metrical reason for that. You know, whose woods these are, I think I know, and you move back. His house is in the village, though. Well, if you don't write metrically formal or regular verse, then you can turn back any time, but you have to turn back before you get to the end of the page, otherwise you're writing prose. You don't want that to happen. So the turning back also is telling the reader, get back in here. Where are you going? Get back in here. This is the body of the poem. Come back into the body of the poem. So it's got recirculating your attention back into the poem, back into the poem. Shakespeare's sonnets are good like that. You know, they come on, the way it holds your attention in that grip. So that's what I'm thinking about good lines. I want to write one line at a time, and I want it to be a unit of something. Could be a unit of grammar, or a unit of metaphor, or humor, or whatever. But Charles Olson said, no line must sleep. No line must sleep. Every line should be aware of the lines, of the words around it, the other lines around it. So that brings the poem. It brings the attention of the poem to itself when the poet is writing one line at a time, and that's the way the poem progresses, one line at a time.
Billy Collins' latest collection is Water, Water Poems. It is published by Random House. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. Special thanks to the New York State Writers Institute and the UAlbany Creative Life Series. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.